You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko manuwa tōku ingoa, nau mai, hari mai, mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Theo. Whai Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the civil defence payment for disaster victims, the state of the economy, and Waitangi Day. I then spoke to Professor of General Practice and Primary Care, Bruce Arrol, on the changes being made to ADHD diagnosis and access to medical treatments. Theo, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with the spokesperson for Ka Lahui Hawaii, Hialani Sonoropale, on the 17-member delegation to Waitangi from Hawaii and solidarity between Māori and Kanaka Māori. I then spoke to public health medicine specialist Dr. Sainemere Boladuadua on the Pacific shift in global health she and her colleagues have proposed.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tōku potahi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wā e ware ware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki enei korero anō, e pakihiri ruki ruki mārunga i te pai. Tuku tuku i rirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM ira katikon. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
It was just 2 weeks ago, following weather warnings and torrential rain, that flooding and slips across Northland, Coromandel and the Bay of Plenty wreaked havoc, cutting off communities, damaging houses and taking at least 9 lives. Since the disaster, the Green Party has been advocating for the activation of the civil defence payment, a fund put aside to provide a modicum of support to get people back on their feet. Last week, the government announced its activation. And the quality of our lives, the affordability of our food, the pay of our jobs, and the success of our enterprises and arts, all summed up in the words state of the economy, in the run-up to the election, where Kiwis will get to their say on if we feel the current government has been good kaitiaki of our economy or not. The measures of its success are becoming increasingly fought over. What measures are thought to be important may well impact who gets to govern us for the next 3 years. And finally, this Friday, we celebrate the 186 years since the signing of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, or the Treaty of Waitangi, in 1840, that laid the foundation for the creation of the New Zealand state today. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the state of the economy and how we commemorate Waitangi Day, but began by asking him about the government's activation of the civil defence payment that he had advocated for.
Hello, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
I want to start us off today by talking about something we talked about last time, which was the Civil Defence Fund. You advocated for its use after the flooding, and I wanted to first hear about what it would do for people.
Yeah, so we came out and asked the government to put in place a civil defence payment, which is a payment available through the Ministry of Social Development so that people can recover lost clothing, kai, bedding, or lost income due to not being able to work, or, for example, the cost of temporary accommodation. It's just one tool in the toolkit that we thought should have been deployed from the get-go. We're really happy that it now has been deployed, and we've been trying to ensure that people are aware that it's out there and that they can simply, if they Google civil defence payment, call the 0800 number and request it if they were affected by the extreme weather events. And now we're calling it for it to be increased because it hasn't been in over 13 years.
That was going to be my next question, in fact. Is it enough? And if it's not enough, maybe you can tell us why.
So the civil defense payment amounts haven't kept up with inflation. The last time it was updated, it was in 2013. And so as we know, the cost of food, bedding, clothing, rent have all increased in the past decade or so, but that payment hasn't. If you're someone who lost everything, for example, right now you can only access $400 to recover basically all your bedding, clothing, and kai as a single person. We don't think that is good enough. And I know this firsthand because in the Auckland floods of 2023, when I was helping families access that payment, I could see that if you're a family that lost literally everything, you need far more to be able to get your life back in order. And so this is why we think the government should update this payment. It's not a payment that is used very often, and this is why we think it's something that the government could easily do to just simply ensure that families are adequately supported when disaster strikes.
Are you worried at all that climate change is going to be increasing the costs of funds such as this, and that our ability to fund them might eventually become eroded if we don't put in place new structures?
So climate change will indeed accelerate and intensify these extreme weather events. But I think what the government needs to do is not just increase its civil defense payment, because ultimately that's not necessarily the more structural work that needs to happen for us to adapt to the to a changing climate, but also to prevent climate change from getting worse, which is why we've long called for the government to also put in place things like funds to make sure that we're building with nature as opposed to against it, so that we build cities and towns that can sponge up flooding events when they happen, so that then families don't have to lose their belongings in the first place, but also that we do enough to transition to a clean economy that allows people to have what they need to thrive. So, for example, investing in things like rail so that we can reduce our transport emissions and people can have access to fast, free, and reliable public transport.
Okay, I want to pivot now into our next topic, which is going to be the economy. There has been lots of talk about the economy, lots of people considering it very important potentially for the outcome of this coming election. The National Party has talked about green shoots in the economy, that things are starting to recover, bounce back, do better. Do you agree?
The government is largely relying on house prices shooting back up in order for the so-called GDP to move up as well. But I think when we talk about the economy, we're talking about people. And what we're seeing on the streets, it's homelessness being on the rise, people finding themselves without jobs and struggling to get into entry-level jobs particularly. And for us, that's why our focus of our economic plan is to ensure that we focus on creating jobs. We've already produced some documents around what we would intend to do, which would include creating tens of thousands of jobs in the construction and manufacturing sector particularly, so that we can, for example, stop exporting raw construction materials to then only import them back far more expensive once they've been processed offshore. We think we can build that capacity here and diversify our economy so that it's not so reliant on dairy and tourism and expensive house prices in order for these green shoots to appear.
What would you say to government spokespeople that would point towards businesses that might be kept afloat through reliance on personal mortgages or things such as that, which might become more sustainable in the current environment?
Well, that ultimately the government is relying on the market fixing itself. And we know that ultimately, when the government talks about the economy recovering, they're often talking about GDP figures, right? And that is simply just a measure of how much money is moving around the economy. It's not a measure necessarily of whether people have enough to eat, whether people actually have good enough jobs. And so I think the government is simply relying on the same system that has brought us inequality, that has brought us economic hardship. And when it comes to the mortgages and how the government hopes that the economy is kept afloat, a lot of it relies on people getting into personal debt in order to make ends meet and or to, for example, being able to finance entering a business. And we don't think that's necessarily a sustainable way of doing things.
And with those policies around focusing on job creation and moving away from those dominant industries such as dairy and tourism, could you maybe give us a bit of an outline of those policies, how they might look?
Well, so one of the things things that we want to do in the construction sector is make sure that we're able to build public housing at scale, that we actually are able to have a green ministry of work that is able to plan and support the creation of the workforce that will allow us to build tens of thousands of public housing. This is housing that will be far cheaper than the current private housing available for rents, and we hope that it is available to a greater proportion of people. But then when it comes to manufacturing, we've long called now for us to be able to process wood onshore. So we think that we're able to invest in the manufacturing sector in order for us to not have to, like I mentioned, export wood only to be processed offshore and then being reinvested here, being imported here. We think this will drive down the cost of construction materials and will allow us to actually have a far more resilient economy as well. So these are two examples of it, but we also think that investing in renewables is another area that will yield lower energy prices and will also ensure that we're able to, as well, diversify the economy that we have. These are all plans that we'll talk more in the election year and we'll expand on what we created in the Green Budget last year as well.
The Green Party is oftentimes characterized by its opponents as one that is anti-worker in the employment sense, in the taxing the utes or such. Do you feel that these policies help change that narrative?
Well, we've long supported better rights for workers, and when it comes to, I guess, some of the characterizations by the likes of New Zealand First, we've often actually called for us to have a more resilient and sovereign economy that is not so reliant on the US, that is not so reliant on big corporations that are coming from offshore. And one of the key things that we've called for when it comes to tax reform is to make sure that we have a tax-free threshold for everyday workers, because at the moment we tax work a lot, but we don't tax wealth enough. And so the rich are able to actually put their wealth in things like property, while everyday people end up getting taxed quite a bit when it comes to their everyday earnings. And we think that we need to rebalance the tax system so that actually it benefits everyday workers, and then the wealthy few actually end up paying their fair share. So we're quite happy to debate our opponents when it comes to those proposals and stereotypes that they wish to put forward, and we're ready for that fight come election year.
All right. Now I want to move on to our final topic. 186 years ago, the Treaty of Waitangi, or Te Tiriti o Waitangi, was signed, and as we move in to Waitangi Day this coming Friday, I would like to know your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to Waitangi Day and Te Tiriti, what I think Te Tiriti can bring all of us, and I say this as somebody who is a migrant to Aotearoa, is unity. It's a sense of identity and a sense of belonging. Te Tiriti is in some ways our first formal immigration document. And I think for too long, we have had people painting Te Tiriti as something that threatens the livelihoods of non-Māori. But really, what it does, it grants us as our founding document, and it also guarantees us rights and the promise that we will all be looked after, while at the same time acknowledging that Māori have kaitiaki rights over this whenua and that sovereignty was never ceded. And so if anything, I hope that we can move to a place where we see Te Tiriti as something that can bring us together as opposed to something that supposedly threatens everyday people's rights to just have a good life, access to healthcare, education, and good jobs.
Waitangi Day has oftentimes been a moment of protest or activism. Do you feel that this current moment is one that needs speaking to?
Well, look, we've seen protest and resistance against the government's attacks on Te Tiriti outside of Waitangi Day already, and I don't expect that this Waitangi Day will be any different. But I think all these activations come from a place of people being extremely concerned about the fact that this government seems fixated on attacking the rights of Māori, when actually their focus should be on ensuring that people have access to a decent job, that they have access to good education, healthcare, and that we honour the founding document that promised all of us to be well looked after. And so I expect that there will be activations and that the Crown will be rightfully held accountable for their ongoing breaches of Titiriti, and that this government needs to front up to the fact that whether it's the Regulatory Standards Act or, for example, the Treaty Principles Bill that was initially proposed in this term, or the RMA reforms that bypassed iwi and hapu voices, all those things, I think that the government will be held to account in Waitangi Bay, no doubt, and rightfully so, as it should be.
And finally, how will you be spending your Waitangi Day, Ricardo?
I will be in Tamaki Makaurau and I'll be at Waitangi at Waititi with my Green Party colleagues. And some of us will stay in Waitangi to at the dawn ceremony as well.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Have a fantastic Waitangi Day.
And likewise. Thank you.
Wish you all the best.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the civil defence payment for disaster victims, the state of the economy, and Waitangi Day.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
We'll be right back.
summer. So if you want to win a pass to a party like no other, with an insane lineup by a pristine beach, with a bunch of friends you haven't met yet, then grab that B card and stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your chance to win.
Splore 2026, Beachside Tāpapakanga Regional Park, February 20th to 22nd. Get your tickets at splore.net.
Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no-hat, no-play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Mini Haha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
The original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
That was Dying Is For Suckers by The Mint Chicks, and before that, Rusty Cage by Soundgarden. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. This week, political, cultural and community leaders have been gathering in Waitangi to commemorate the signing of Te Tiriti. However, recent attacks on Te Tiriti, Te Reo Māori and Te Ao Māori by the New Zealand Coalition Government are front of mind for many. Ka Lahui Hawaii, a Kanaka Māori initiative calling for self-determination and self-governance in Hawaii, have sent a 17-member delegation to show solidarity with Māori. To understand the demonstration of Indigenous solidarity this delegation represents, as well as the ongoing colonial attacks on Indigenous peoples across the Pacific, I spoke to spokesperson for Ka Lahui Hawaii, Hialani Sonoda Pale. Kia ora, Hialani. So first of all, how can I address you?
You can just address me as Hialani.
Cool. So starting off, can you tell us a little bit about who Ka Lahui Hawaii are? Like, how was the initiative formed and what do they strive for?
Yes. Ka Lahui Hawaii is a Native initiative for self-determination and self-governance. It was formed in 1987 by a grassroots Kanaka Maoli, or Native people of Hawaii. And it is a been around since then. We advocate on behalf of Kanaka Maoli rights, lands, culture, and we also advocate for the protection of our sacred spaces.
Cool, and I understand that Ka Lahui Hawaii have sent a delegation to Aotearoa's Waitangi commemorations this year.
Yes, we have 17 Kanaka Maoli that we have brought as part of our delegation, ranging from youth to elders, and we are here to help to raise awareness of what is happening here in Aotearoa with the attacks against Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and in support of the Maori people, the Native people of Aotearoa, for the protection of their rights and their lands and their sacred spaces.
Yeah, and given our connection through the Pacific and shared histories, can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between Aotearoa and Hawaii?
Yes, Aotearoa has been a model for us in terms of their struggle to revitalize their language, and we have been following that template. But our struggle is rooted in that, in issues like that, and progress we've made in that, but it's also rooted in our shared colonial history, we have different colonizers. Aotearoa was colonized by the British Empire, and Hawaii was colonized by the United States of America. And so our colonization was a little different, but it was very similar. It ended in the disenfranchisement of Native peoples, the loss of our lands, and the loss of our language, and the separation and destruction of our sacred places. So we have similar struggles, because the end goal of colonization is to get rid of us and to take our land. And so that the settler colonial project to replace the native hasn't ended. It's still ongoing. It's just changed faces and names. But this new attack on the indigenous people of Aotearoa, it really spoke to us, because we are under similar attacks. There is a global right-wing conservative political movement that's happening globally, and so we're under attack right now in Hawaii by this right-wing conservative group, and we see similarities in Aotearoa happening with their right-wing conservative group attacking all of the progress and all of the rights that Maori have, and also pulling back on the progress made in all the decades prior from prior struggles. So the Maoris have made progress in terms of language, culture, and protecting some of their sacred sites. We have as well. But all of that progress that we've made over the decades in our struggle for self-determination, for regaining back some political say in our future, all of that progress being made that has been made is all being pulled back by this global movement that seems very conservative and right-wing. And so we are, we see that similarity happening, and we have come to stand in solidarity. We know that building these networks in Oceania between indigenous peoples, the native peoples of all the islands, is important for us to be successful. In order for us to be successful, we need to build power outside of these colonial structures and in the community with each other. And so we're calling out the New Zealand government on what they're doing to our Maori cousins. By doing so, we're bringing attention to our struggles, we're building power, and we're showing other indigenous peoples of the Pacific what they can do as well. We should all be standing in solidarity with each other for all of our different struggles, because it's the same struggle. We're all fighting and struggling for liberation here in Oceania.
Yeah, and on that kind of note of this shared struggle, how can Aotearoa reciprocate the support shown by Ka Lahui Hawaii to the Kanaka Maoli in Hawaii?
I think the way we do shared struggle is to recognize each other's history, recognize each other. Coming here to Waitangi has been an experience in terms of being recognized as a Native nation by the Native people of Aotearoa, and we can reciprocate that when Maoris come to our lands. But just by that recognition and by understanding how we are related, we have genealogical ties as well with each other, going back to the beginning of time from Mother Earth and Sky Father. We all come from that genealogy. But what is important is that mutual recognition. We know the Maoris will stand with us when we need them. They have in the past. They came to the Mauna when we stood against the 30-meter telescope. They helped us revitalize our language. They stood with us against nuclear bombing in the Pacific. So we know that from the past, that when we all come together and we stand together, that we can make more of a difference. And so I think for us being in Waitangi, the recognition from the Maori people has been gratefully received and has been very touching for us and also empowering our youth. We brought some of our youth with us, and I think that's going to be empowering for them to see that recognition. But we know from the past that the Maori have stood with us and will continue to stand with us in our various struggles in the future. We're here to reciprocate that.
That was spokesperson for Ka Lahui Hawaii, Hialani Sonodopale, on the Kanaka Maoli delegation to Waitangi in solidarity for Indigenous peoples across the Pacific.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
That was I, Zimbra by the Talking Heads. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. ADHD is one of the most common disorders in the world, with estimates ranging between 5 to 8% of kids dealing with its symptoms every day, and most will be dealing with them well into adulthood. For over a decade, the rules regulating diagnosis and treatment options available to those with ADHD have been demanding, costing a lot and requiring access to a selection of specialists with long wait times. New changes will now see GPs be able to diagnose and prescribe medication for those 18 and up. To understand what these changes will mean, I spoke to Professor of General Practice and Primary Care at the University of Auckland, Dr. Bruce Carroll. Now, you've released this statement on ADHD prescription changes that have been going through at a national level. Could you talk about what the state of ADHD prescription was before these changes?
Before this, you had to have a psychiatrist or a pediatrician if you, or a child psychiatrist if you're an adolescent or adult. You had to have an adult psychiatrist for adults who wanted to get medication for ADHD. From the 1st of February, GPs can do, for adults, can do assessments and diagnosis and initiate treatment. And some nurse practitioners who have training in mental health work as well. So there's two different groups there.
So this will expand who can diagnose ADHD, is that correct?
Yep.
And will this also impact who can prescribe ADHD medication?
Oh, yeah, there'll be a lot more. There'll be potentially every GP in the country. Not every GP will want to do it because the assessment process takes about an hour and a half. And so that might be done with people like health improvement practitioners in the clinic, getting family history, past history, school performance, questionnaire for PTSD, depression, anxiety, because you may appreciate ADHD is a bit of a soft diagnosis and it overlaps with a whole bunch of other things. So you want to sort out if somebody's got anxiety or depression and that's why they're struggling rather than the ADHD. Having said that, these days pretty well everybody who turns up has screened themselves on the internet and usually do have ADHD. So people criticise doctors for giving it to everybody, but actually everybody turning up has it because there's a huge backlog. And it's a spectrum disorder. We all have little bits of it. I have a little bit of it. So there's people who've got it badly, people who don't have it badly. Some people don't have any of it at all.
Is this going to make it easier for people to get access to medication that they might need? Is this a positive thing in your mind?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, this is democratizing. And you shouldn't have to pay large amounts of money to see a private psychiatrist to get it.
That was Professor of General Practice and Primary Care at the University of Auckland, Dr. Bruce Arrell, on the changes being made to ADHD diagnosis and medication, making them more available. We'll be right back after this short song. Keep it on the beat.
We'll be right back.
That was Bull in the Heather by Sonic Youth, and before that, Seabird by Dreary. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
Colonization continues to deeply affect the Pacific, with the production of health inequities tied closely to the unequal power dynamics still inflicted on Pacific nations by external high-income countries. A recent article by a group of women academics and health professionals based in Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, and Aotearoa, New Zealand, has called for a reimagining in how global health is approached in the Pacific. This proposed shift would see greater sovereignty exercised by Pacific nations in research and health, and a pluralistic worldview reflecting indigenous Pacific knowledge systems. To understand the state of global health in the Pacific, the reimagining her group has proposed, and the role that Aotearoa New Zealand can play, I spoke to public health medicine specialist Dr. Sainemere Boladuadua. Kia ora, Dr. Sainemere Boladuadua.
Kia ora, Theo. Please, just call me Sai.
Cool. So you and your colleagues have recently put out an article calling for a reimagining for global health in the Pacific. So starting off, I just wanted to talk about what global health means.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Theo. And thank you for the interest and for having me on. Global health is basically, it's a field of practice, study, research that focuses on achieving better health outcomes for people, for vulnerable populations and communities around the world. So it looks at health issues that aren't restricted to countries, but they go beyond or they transcend national borders. So things like pandemics, climate change, movement of people, and addresses these issues, but also in a way that is fair and improves health for everyone. And so it's interdisciplinary, it's beyond just hospitals and doctors and nurses, but people from or expertise from many fields like sociology, economics, and then environmental science, education, because our health is shaped by all these things. Eh? In public health, we talk about the socioeconomic determinants of health, so how health is influenced by things like access to clean water, safe housing, income, politics, the environment. So bringing in a multidisciplinary approach to addressing these health issues. It's also about looking at systems that keep our communities healthy, like strong health services, health systems, workforce, trained workforce, reliable suppliers, good policies, all these things that can help countries respond not only to emergencies for like for example, when the COVID pandemic happened, but also just ongoing challenges like you know, like diabetes, heart disease, mental health issues, day-to-day health issues.
And what is the current kind of state of global health or our idea of that state in the Pacific right now?
So currently in the Pacific, we are facing some of the biggest challenges in the world. For example, like climate change, that's a rising sea levels, food systems that are changing, economic pressures. And these things, these issues are shaped by forces from outside the region. Like climate change, for example, we disproportionately bear the brunt of this issue that's caused by forces outside the Pacific region. Things like another big health issues are non-communicable diseases, like diabetes and heart disease. Very common, extremely common in the Pacific, partly because of the way our food systems have changed, our lifestyles have been influenced by globalization of global trade, processed imports, for example. And in terms of climate change, the impacts of climate change is like more frequent cyclones, water contamination, community displacements, and how all this impacts health of our communities, health and well-being of our communities. So these are the health issues. Some of the biggest things. At the same time, we do have in the Pacific, we have strong leadership. We've got our own, indigenous knowledge systems, and we have resilient communities as well. And we've shown how capable we are in responding to crisis, for example, the COVID pandemic and also natural disasters. It's a it's common in, I think, in the Pacific, and we've learned how to respond to it. There's a long history of collaboration in the Pacific, among Pacific nations. You know, we're small Pacific Island countries, and we can't do things by ourselves, so we've learned to, in a way, to work with each other. So connection is a real strength. For example, in terms of when we have natural disasters, there's often teams that go out from one Pacific Island country. I'll give you an example, like the Fiji Emergency Medical Assistance Team, made up of health professionals. They've gone out and helped other neighboring countries like Vanuatu when they had a cyclone, or Samoa during outbreak responses. So just examples of that, of how collaboration and connection within the Pacific. So just, yeah, summarize, we've got huge health challenges. We do have strong local leadership, and we've got our own indigenous knowledge systems and practices to draw on. But also, well, one of the biggest issues in global health right now is the power imbalances. Too often when decisions about Pacific health are made, it's made outside the region. And so this plays out in terms of inequities in funding, in remuneration, in leadership. So when funding comes in for, you know, in terms of response to disasters, or for in terms of health interventions, this power imbalance, because it's the decisions are being made primarily from outside the region by the organizations or the countries that provide the funding, that affects whose voices are heard, whose knowledge is valued, and whose priorities on whose agenda shape the health programs or health interventions. That is basically the incentive to think about how can we do, or we need to do things differently. Yeah? And there is a growing movement around this. We're not the only ones who've said this, to articulate this, that we need to do things a bit differently in the Pacific. Yeah.
Thinking about that connectivity that you're talking about, that kind of reflects a lot of what I read in your article, coming from the late Professor Ebele Haofa, about the Pacific as a sea of islands rather than a sea with islands separated by it. So thinking about that kind of connectivity and how all these issues are quite externally projected and coming in from external forces, what is the shift that your colleagues and you have put forward, and how to meet these kind of externally imposed issues and challenges?
So we're just pushing for, you know, more Pacific-led solutions, greater sovereignty, self-determination, right? That we determine what our own priorities are, and a shift towards integrating Indigenous with Western approaches in anything. Because of colonization, you know, our Indigenous ways of knowing and being is viewed as inferior. And when we carry out health interventions or health programs, it's usually just according to the Western model, right? This is what's seen to have worked. This is in the literature, in the international literature, evidence based. This is what should be done. Often without any consideration of the local people and what their worldviews are and how they do things. And, it seems like a no-brainer, but it seems like common sense, but doesn't often happen. Just the acknowledgement of the Indigenous ways of doing. We've got our own ways of, traditional ways of things. So just bringing those two up, integrating them, you know, it'll be a win-win situation. Get the best of both worlds to do things like that. So, yeah, just the shift towards this more Pacific-led solutions, you know, more local capacity building.
And what role can Aotearoa New Zealand play in facilitating this shift?
I think Aotearoa New Zealand has been a great ally and a partner in this respect. I may be biased, but in my experience of working in the Pacific, being on the other side and being a recipient of, you know, like Aotearoa assistance, technical expertise, aid, my experience is, as compared to other countries, work a bit differently. And I think that comes from just our proximity to each other. And we know, you know, we're familiar with the ways of working with each other and our long history of living together and working together. But how we could change this is just our approach. Aotearoa New Zealand, as if researchers or practitioners, organizations that come to work in the Pacific, just having that maybe having a look at the approach that they take. Making an effort to find out what the issues are on the ground, the issues as well as the solutions, not to come in with just, you know, preconceived ideas and agenda of what you think would work best, but working with the locals and finding out what works best as well. Like I said before, there's a place for both Western knowledge and Indigenous knowledge. I think it's a win-win if we integrate both. So consider, yes, definitely consider what the international evidence, the evidence says in the literature, also find out how, what the local knowledge, you know, what's worked here, what's worked well before, integrate that. Allyship, coming alongside the locals to roll out the health programs and health interventions, but also helping build the local capacity. There's a lot of, there already is local expertise and knowledge there, but how can we improve that? We've got some great examples of great partnerships already. Group, for example, that I work with, it's a collaboration between the University of Auckland, Cure Kids, and Ministry of Health in Fiji. The university has its own metrics and parameters around these types of collaborations, but just the willingness for the New Zealand organization to listen and to partner with, like, genuinely to partnership, and I think the term that comes to mind is manaakitanga, like, just if you're able to practice manaakitanga, not just within New Zealand but everywhere we go, like, your approach is mana enhancing, lifting up respectful ways of working, it will improve, like, anything that you do, health outcomes and equity, health equity that we're trying to do here.
That was public health medicine specialist Dr. Sainemere Boladuadua on the recent call she and her colleagues have put forward for a reimagining in how global health is approached in the Pacific.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Ko ira. Ko ira.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tenei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero maeke mātou mo tenei rā. That's a wrap for The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, spokesperson for Ka Lohia Hawaii, Heolani Sanadoa Pale, Professor of General Practice and Primary Care at the University of Auckland, Dr. Bruce Arrol, and Public Health Medicine Specialist, Dr. Senimere Boladuadua. Nei rā huki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to the 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Eilish.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.